Case will be taken under advisement, and we'll proceed to the fourth case this morning, which is Sobieski versus Indiana Harbor Steamship. Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you, members of the panel. My name is Dennis O'Brien. I was not counsel of record at the time the motion for summary judgment under scrutiny was argued or resolved by the court. There's basically two forms of liability being claimed in this case: direct liability for the tort of Mr. Barrett and liability for failure to supervise Mr. Barrett by the defendant through its officers. Now, address the direct liability first. As this court stated in the Wilson case at note 2 at page 1356, under most definitions of course of employment, the plaintiff must show that the employee's tort was in attempted, though often misguided, furtherance of the employer's business. That's what we had to create a question of fact with regard thereto. And in order for the defendant to prevail on that issue, it had to show, as articulated by the court in Copeland, which was quoted in my brief, that in order for summary judgment to be granted, the district court must have correctly found, quote, that the acts of the fellow employee which caused plaintiff's injury were wholly outside the scope of his employment, intended only to further his own interests and not those of the employer, and were not chargeable to his employer. And that is the test. And there's one other caveat that should be noted, because we're examining the actions of the purportedly negligent co-employee, not those of the plaintiff, as to whether those actions were in the course of his employment. And as stated by the Baker case, the Sixth Circuit case, which was cited by this court with approval in the Wilson case, stated, contrasted with, quote, whether an injured employee was acting within the scope of his employment at the time he was injured, and here the plaintiff was in the scope of his employment, he was on break, a more liberal rule would apply in determining whether the acts of a negligent employee were within the scope of his employment.
Am I wrong in thinking that your position would hold an employer liable for all negligent acts which occur on a vessel?
In part, but that's not the basis of... I'll get to that. That's the rule that we're proposing, but we don't have to have the court adopt that rule in order for us to prevail in this appeal. That's not a rule that has to be adopted by this court in order for the plaintiff to prevail on this appeal.
Why?
Because with regard to the tests that I just articulated, the plaintiff satisfied those tests in terms of creating a question of fact. And that was admitted by the lower court, but the lower court failed to appreciate it. When the lower court stated on page 17 of the opinion, the fact that Mr. Barrett's motivation in cracking Mr. Sobieski's neck was to make Mr. Sobieski more comfortable and consequently to make him a better, more efficient employee, admittedly an act that would have ultimately assisted the employer, does not bring the action within the scope of his employment. So the negligent act of Mr. Barrett had a belief that it was benefiting the employer. It was not an act that he did to personally benefit himself. Mr. Barrett's belief was that it was benefiting the employer.
Are you saying that you believe that you have established an issue of fact on whether the action that was taken was a customer practice that was authorized by the employer, or that the employer was negligent in not prohibiting the practice?
That's the second species of liability. That's not the species of liability I'm discussing right now. I'm stating that the employer is directly responsible for Mr. Barrett's act because Mr. Barrett reasonably believed that his act was in furtherance of the employer's business and beneficial.
Counsel, that's not a form of direct liability. That's a form of vicarious liability, respondeat superior liability.
I agree with that.
The second claim is a direct liability claim.
I'm sorry?
The second claim that you're making is a direct liability claim, the employer's own liability for its failure to supervise.
I stand corrected. We can say vicarious liability. I understand what you're saying. I don't disagree with that. The lower court analogized this situation to the Atlas case, where you had two individuals who were off the vessel, and the court assumed that if they had just gotten off the vessel to eat and come back to work, they'd be in the course of their employment. But those two individuals went and got sloppy drunk for 3 hours and were injured coming back to the boat. And the court ruled that they were outside of the course of their employment, and they were never brought back within their employment because they were drunk coming back to the boat. These two individuals were on the vessel. They were both in the course of their employment. They never left the course of their employment. And the court ruled that Mr. Barrett's belief that it was benefiting the employer did not bring the action within the scope of his employment. He never left the scope of his employment. Mr. Barrett was never outside the scope of the employment. The question is whether this act took him outside the scope of his employment. He didn't need to be brought back in. He never left. He was on the vessel. So his belief...
But at that time, the magistrate judge was talking about his motivation. You're not saying whatever he thought internally brings it within the scope of his employment, are you?
Oh, that's what I'm saying, sure.
So
his subjective belief, if it was reasonable, that he was benefiting the employer, then his acts are within the scope of his employment. And that's what this court ruled in Wilson. Okay, where the court suggested a different rule in Wilson was that it may not be necessary that it be proved that the employee's acts were in furtherance of the employer's business or to benefit the employer. But the garden variety test is, did the negligent actor reasonably believe that his actions would benefit the employer?
So unwanted touching, suppose... The person who had his neck cracked here would have been a woman. Would your theory be the same?
If it was purely for therapeutic purposes,
well,
it's
his motivation, his idea.
Well, I think there. Yes, if it was with a non-sexual purpose.
No, I'm not saying it was sexual, but
I don't think whether it's a man or a woman would be any different. I don't think it'd be any different if you have somebody out there on Lake Michigan today, and
if the person receiving it felt it was a sexual.
Well, then you might have some other issues and intrude. Okay,
but it'd still be within the scope of his employment, according to your theory, right?
Yes, it would be if the actor was doing it for a therapeutic or reason that he thought to be beneficial to the employer. Yes. I don't think it's any different if somebody's out on Lake Michigan today and comes in to watch television because they're cooped up on the vessel and the individual's feet are frozen cold. And he's sitting there watching television. He's complaining about it. And he dozes off and somebody goes and gets him a hot pan of water to put his feet in and puts his feet in it without the person knowing it, and his feet become scalded because of hot water. The actor had a purpose beneficial to the employer, and I think that's the test to be applied and scrutinized.
You're into your rebuttal time. If you want to save some, you're going to have to.
I understand. With regard to the first argument we made in our brief, there's been different courts nibbling around the edges as to whether there should be an even more liberal test applied under the Jones Act. And that was not an argument made in the lower court, but I think that even under the traditional rule, we prevail, and this court can face front and center those statements that have been made by other courts as to whether there should be a more liberal rule under the Jones Act. Okay, mm-hmm. And then when you get to the issue with regard to the failure to supervise, the lower court acknowledged that Mr. Barrett testified that officers had seen him do it before. Okay, and in the Lancaster case, this court ruled that any supervisory employee qualifies as an agent of the defendant with regard to notice as to whether the defendant should have gotten wind of the unsafe practice. Here,
counsel, your time has expired.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to start on the furtherance of the employer's interest. Mr. O'Brien said that the Wilson case out of this circuit cited the Baker case with approval. It did not. In fact, it cited Baker for the proposition that there was enterprise liability, which the Baker court seemed to accept in place of the furtherance of the employer's interest, and that actually, the Wilson case said that Baker had forgotten to consider the purpose of the FVLA and of the Jones Act, which was not to expand the basis of respondeat superior liability. It was to remove the fellow servant bar to liability of railroad workers under the FVLA. And that essentially is what the purpose was of the Jones Act when it was passed in the first instance, too, was to remove the fellow employee bar, the fellow servant bar, to liability. So it's very clear that Baker is not accepted as authority in this circuit for the standard under which respondeat superior liability is to be measured. Mr. O'Brien cited the Copeland case for the proposition that a person's subjective intent to assist the employer is what governs. I think he's wrong for a number of reasons. Number one, if he is right with a blanket statement like that, then any employee whose intent to help the employer is real, even though unreasonable, can bind the employer to his act just because he intended to help the employer. We know that that's not the law in the Seventh Circuit by the Rogers case, which rejected a jogger's argument that running on company property while he was on call but off duty was intended to benefit the employer by making him more fit to do his job. And the Rogers court said flat out, this is not a reasonable position to take. It is unreasonable. And that is why the Rogers court said there was no need to look at the restatement factors to check for reasonableness, because no one could hold a reasonable belief. The Rogers case is a lot like this case, Your Honor. In Rogers, you've got an FELA worker who traveled from one city to another. I believe it was to Clinton, Iowa. In Clinton, Iowa, he got off duty, but he stayed at a company barracks on call but off duty, which would be the status of Mr. Barrett at the time of this particular incident. And he decided to go jogging on the company property. There was no indication of a company policy that encouraged physical fitness or required physical fitness or required him to do this here. He did it of his own volition, and he was injured. He claimed that he was trying to benefit the employer, and the Rogers Court said no one could hold a reasonable view that this was of benefit to the employer. The Barrett case is very much like that. In Barrett, we've got a man, a Meats assistant, who does not do any sort of medical work. He steers the boat, he watches, he looks out, he works on deck, he runs winches, he takes hatch covers off, clamps and unclamps, runs hatch cranes, who for whatever reason had a subjective, who for whatever reason decided that he would assist Mr. Sobieski by massaging or cracking his neck when Mr. Sobieski looked and according to Mr. Barrett, said his neck was sore. Now, Mr. Sobieski either agreed to this or he didn't. Take your pick. You've got two witnesses, one who says one and one who says the other. But in either case, Mr. Barrett's subjective intent, if you take a look at the transcript pages, was not to help the employer. Nowhere in there does he say he intended to help the employer. He says his intent was to make the man's neck feel better.
Would you acknowledge any situation in which an off-duty action by a worker to improve the health of a coworker could be held to further the ship's business?
I think there probably are situations. The analysis breaks down into what are core duties, essential duties, and what are incidental duties. And some things are clearly incidental duties. I mean, if you have a man who stays on a ship 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as these men do for a month or two or three at a time, then you've got to expect that they're going to do normal off-duty activities that you'd expect of anybody while they are not working. They're going to eat. They're going to sleep. They're going to wash. They're going to have activities to pass the time by. They're going to play cards. They're going to watch television. And if in the course of doing any of these things, something were to happen where one were to injure another, probably there would be an arguable case of liability. And I know I'm generalizing, and the devil's always in the details, but to a general question like that, I've got to give a general answer. Sure there are. But the whole purpose of the FELA and the Jones Act is that somewhere there's an outer periphery beyond which there's no liability because an employee was not acting in the vessel's interest. He wasn't acting in his employer's interests. And it's always hard to figure out exactly where a line is drawn. But this case, I think, is clearly beyond it. We've got no facts whatsoever that would indicate that this is a normal off-duty activity, that anybody had reason to believe this is a normal off-duty activity, that anyone could hold a reasonable belief that an unlicensed seaman performing some sort of medical maneuver, if you will, on another seaman is somehow attributable to the employer, unless you can show that the employer actually knew that this was going to happen or should have known that this was going to happen and should have stopped it before it happened. And I don't think we have evidence of that either. That's the other possibility of liability here is direct liability. One of the cases in the briefs, and I don't remember the name of it, is really an outlandish case in which seamen on a boat while off duty went out to watch seals. And one of them thought it would be a real great idea to get a rifle and shoot at seals. And predictably, he succeeded in shooting one of the human seals that he worked with on the boat. And the ship owner defended on the basis that this was clearly outside the master's business. And the reason that there is liability there is because they were shooting at seals with the master's say-so. The master said, fine. The master was standing there watching them do it. So you had this act that is clearly outside the scope of employment that gets dragged back into the scope of employment because the supervisory personnel on the job said, it's fine with us. Go ahead and do it. Well, if the supervisory personnel know about it and allow it to go on, then literally anything can be within the scope of employment and there can be liability. But that's not what we have here. We've got a guy who occasionally cracks necks. He's done it, according to the evidence that we found, before this, in a 20-year period, he'd done it to two people and had massaged but not cracked the neck of a third person. No one had ever had a complaint. There'd never been a problem. According to the plaintiff, this man snuck up behind him and cracked his neck. Well, if we believe that, how can there possibly be notice to anybody? Because the guy had never done that before, ever, not even one time. This is a case. I know Jones Act cases are hard to get summary judgment on because there's a lower standard of care. But at some point, there has to be some evidence to support liability. Here, there isn't any. I mean, the plaintiff's got to prove something. He's got to prove a prima facie case to support all the elements of the cause of action. Here, there isn't any. We point to a general comment about officers. Officers knew. Well, who? Mr. O'Brien, in his brief, is critical of me for not following up and asking who those officers were. I think it's worth taking a look at the transcript to see that the person who was doing the questioning at that time was the plaintiff's attorney at the time. And the only reason my interjection is in there is because Mr. Barrett mumbled the answer. I didn't hear it the first time, and I asked to have it repeated. If you go back and you look at that transcript, Mr. Cunningham, the attorney at the time, is the person who was questioning, and he went on. And by the time we got to my cross-examination, I simply didn't do it. But I was not the one who had the option at the time to do the asking. I did ask afterward. I don't care to go outside the record unless I'm instructed to. But the evidence of record is that no officer in the employ of Central Marine knew about this. None. How can there be a liability when nobody knows what's going on? I'll answer any questions if the panel has
them. I don't think there are any, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time has expired for you, Mr. O'Brien, so the case will be taken under advisement. We'll move to the